Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the fall of Singapore in early 1942 and the catastrophe, really, that befalls the British Empire as a result. Okay, so one question with the fall of Singapore that is worth asking is, how was it that one of the most important imperial assets in British Asia fell so quickly, one where there had been a considerable amount of forethought as to its defence. The entire protection of British Southeast Asia and Australia in the 1930s was said to revolve around the Singapore strategy, which is that Singapore would be a naval base from which British ships, the Royal Navy, would sail to besiege Japan. That a blockade, a naval blockade of Japan, would essentially bring the Japanese home islands to their knees. And that Singapore itself needed to be unassailable from the sea. There were concerns from Australia throughout the 20s and 30s that the Singapore strategy had a fundamental flaw. The fundamental flaw being that it was vulnerable to a land invasion. Australian generals and admirals were significantly alarmed by the Singapore strategy and by the fact that Australia's defence rested upon it, and that in the coming of another world war, Australian troops would be called on probably to defend the Middle East, probably to fight in North Africa, possibly even in Europe, and that there would be a reliance on Singapore to hold the line, so it had better hold. And of course it doesn't, and this plunges Australia in 1942 into an existential crisis, which fortunately it survived only by dint of the fact that the Japanese looked objectively at the size of Australia and realised that they wouldn't be able to occupy it. Australia for Japan was simply a continent that needed to be cut off and be brought to its knees. Australia couldn't represent a possible landing place for America, because that would spell doom for Japan's war effort, as indeed it does. Anyway, so the Singapore strategy was the basis of everything that the British pinned their hopes on for defence against most likely Japan in Asia. As the British abandoned Malaya and fled down the peninsula to Johor and then across the straits to Singapore, their reputation in Asia was forever tarnished, indeed destroyed. The Malays, the Malay Chinese and Malay Indian subjects of the British Empire, desperate for protection from the merciless onslaught of the Japanese, were abandoned by the British in the most callous fashion. Max Hastings writes, the commissioner in Penang refused to allow Malay firefighters to enter the European quarter after bombing raids and rejected pleas to demolish some European houses to create a firebreak. When Penang Island was evacuated, non-Europeans were denied access to shipping. A Chinese judge was evicted after boarding, though the fortress commander's car was embarked. A woman refugee from the island later said that the manner of the British evacuation was a thing I am sure will never be forgotten or forgiven. Sikh police in Singapore were assured by the British chief that he would stay with them to the end. Instead, he fled. In the Cameron Highlands, departing settlers appealed to Asian members of the local defence force to stick with their units. Unsurprisingly, they resigned in block. In Kuala Lumpur, British doctors abandoned hospital wards to the care of their Asian counterparts. A young actor with a Chinese theatre troupe told his audience in the mining centre of Ipoh, "The British are treating their empire as property and handling the whole thing as if it was a business transaction." Harper and Bailey write in Forgotten Wars, Forgotten Armies, I beg your pardon, it's the first one. "The moral collapse of the British rule in Southeast Asia came not at Singapore but at Penang. The retreat through Perak had left Britain's oldest possession in Malaya stranded. It too was a fortress with a designated fortress commander, but the decision was taken not to defend it. This gave the Japanese assault when it came on the 9th and 10th of December a terrible surreal quality. For the first 2 days, Japanese planes flew reconnaissance missions unchallenged. To E.A. Davis, an employee of the Eastern Smelting Company, working as a volunteer fireman, it was just like an aeronautical display. The whole of Georgetown now turned out to watch. However, on Thursday the 11th of December, the planes attacked with bombs and almost continuous machine gun fire. The spectators were hit in their hundreds. They watched with fascination," wrote Lim Kian Siu, "not knowing what was coming as a shoal of fish would stay to watch in silence as a fisherman surrounds them with a net. A downtown market was a principal target. Parked cars, parked handcarts with their handles pointing towards the sky had been mistaken for AK-AK guns." Again, they confirm Britain's disgrace in the evacuation. "The European evacuation was surreptitious and ignominious. The order to leave came quietly in the night on the 16th of December. Europeans gathered at the Eastern and Oriental Hotel, many of them under strict orders, disgusted at leaving their local staff and servants. Dr. Fisher was told abruptly that it was total war and he was needed elsewhere. Europeans crowded to the docks on every conceivable form of transport, 6 people to a rickshaw." It begs the question, who was pulling the rickshaw, doesn't it? "At the quayside, one senior Asian civil servant who had been served the order, the Chinese judge and the volunteer force officer, Lim Kun Tiek, was turned out of the boat." We heard about him before. Yet the fortress commander still managed to get his car on board, as we know. "The quay was cordoned off by armed volunteers. Survivors from the Prince of Wales manned the ferries that evacuated the women. Many single women demanded to stay, but were ordered out. The manner of the British withdrawal," wrote J.A. Kritzo, "was a thing which I'm sure will never be forgotten or forgiven." One of the long-term effects of Britain's humiliation in Malaya, in Singapore and in Burma, was the end of the notion of European superiority. The idea that Europeans, by some right, had special privileges as colonial overlords, but also special responsibilities as protectors of those who they had conquered. And by the end of the war, the 2 million soldiers of British India's Indian Army would be well aware of the weaknesses of the British, and not just the weaknesses on the battlefield that have been displayed in the fall of Malaya, but also the moral weakness of British rule in Asia. British colonial officials and civilians were, of course, well aware of the savage violence that had been meted out on Europeans in Hong Kong when it had fallen in the early, weeks earlier. And they were also well aware of the policy that the Japanese had towards prisoners. Certainly military prisoners were executed, and a significant number of civilian ones were as well. What they overlooked was the fact that the Chinese in Hong Kong were treated with appalling cruelty too, and that the Chinese, the Malays, and other conquered peoples across Asia would also be treated with savage racial violence. Interestingly, across the rest of the British Empire in Southeast Asia, European and Asian refugees were treated not as welcome guests, but with a great deal of caution. Australia agreed to admit just 50 Europeans and 50 Chinese from Malaya. Ceylon set a limit of 500, with its priority for Ceylonese refugees initially. Immigration was a key issue throughout the whole of the Second World War in countries that remained stable, that remained functioning, that remained free from invasion, because it was well understood that the easiest way to incite ethnic nationalism, which could lead to the development of fascist parties within the nation, which would have all sorts of harmful consequences for the conduct of the war and the continuance of liberal democracy at all, was to allow waves of mass immigration, or at least this was the fear. When, on the 31st of January, the bridge linking Malaya to Singapore was detonated, the principal of Raffles College, on hearing the explosion, asked what it signified. Lee Kuan Yew, who later became the authoritarian leader of post-war Singapore, said simply, "That is the end of the British Empire." And in effect, it was. It took 55 days for the Japanese to advance all the way down the peninsula. They repaired every bridge that the Australians and the British had blown along the way. But the biggest advantage the Japanese had was the fact that the British were led by General Sir Arthur Percival. Percival had twice as many soldiers as Yamashita. Yamashita was fixated on Singapore and said that basically Singapore was the pin at the heart of the fan, that the fan of the British Empire across Asia was governed by Singapore, and if you remove that pin, then the fan would fall apart. Percival had dispersed his forces. He had decided to defend the coastline, a massive strategic error. These were beleaguered and demoralised troops who had simply retreated and retreated in the face of endless Japanese onslaught. They were poorly led. They had relatively inexperienced officers for the most part, due to the huge demand for experienced officers in
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Europe, and they had come to believe, many of them, that the Japanese were unstoppable. The British had quickly shifted from a notion that the Japanese were racially inferior to the idea that they were unbeatable. And there was a sense that the defeat of Singapore was inevitable. And it certainly wasn't by any stretch of the imagination. There was some attempt to evacuate people to the Dutch East Indies. 5,000 set sail, including the commander of the 8th Australian Division, Major General Henry Gordon Bennett. The 8th Australian Division had landed to reinforce Singapore shortly before the city fell, and Bennett fled by ship, escaping after handing control of the division over to a subordinate. He commandeered a sampan with some other junior officers and European escapees through to the Straits of Sumatra, and then eventually made his way back to Australia, where there was an official inquiry into his conduct. On the 8th of February 1942, Yamashita's troops began to land under the cover of darkness after having commandeered 150 small boats, which took 4,000 troops in the first wave, two divisions essentially. The British had no searchlights, or at least they didn't use them, and they were unable to direct artillery. There was very little artillery fire. Shell fire essentially severed the phone communications that the British were reliant on, and the rain left defenders, the British, the Australians, the Indians, and the volunteer Chinese troops to stay within their trenches. The Japanese moved quickly, and the defenders fell back, and it became very clear by the morning of the first day of the invasion of Singapore that the island was doomed. It was Bennett's view, before he fled, that he didn't believe Australian soldiers wanted to fight, which was an entirely unfair observation, given the fighting prowess of the diggers all the way down the Malay Peninsula. Certainly, of all the British and colonial troops who fought, and many did fight bravely, it's the Australians that seem to have distinguished themselves time and time again as combat troops. However, it was perhaps fair to say that by the time successive defeats had been visited upon the British and the Australians in Malaya, by the time they had finally retreated to Singapore, there was a sense of inevitability. As morale amongst the defenders broke down, troops deserted their positions. The account of one corporal, Tomonisuke Tsuchikane, described a sense of bewilderment at having encountered British and Australian soldiers and Indian soldiers who had simply given up fighting. He said, "Having lost their nerve, some soldiers were simply cowering in terror, squatting down and avoiding a hand-to-hand combat in a wait-and-see position. They too were bayoneted or shot without mercy." Now, much is made of the culture of Bushido, the Japanese martial culture that emanates from medieval Japan and, I believe, from the tradition of the samurai. Perhaps too much is made of this. As an explanation for Japanese cruelty and barbarity and the murder of prisoners. Certainly it supplies Japan with a kind of cultural logic to its war crimes. But if you take the example of Nazi war crimes in Poland and Russia and other occupied countries, or Soviet war crimes against the peoples of the east of Europe, or if you look at the way in which German civilians were treated at the end of the war, as 15 million of them migrated out of Eastern Europe, or a whole host of acts of cruelty and violence and savagery on one side and another, from Burma to Croatia, across the entirety of Europe and Asia during the Second World War. Violence doesn't need cultural logic. The mass killing of prisoners is perfectly capable of operating without notions of samurai honour. It is entirely possible, I argue, that the violence that was meted out upon Europeans and upon ethnic Malay, Chinese, Indian, Burmese and other peoples was the result of an extreme outpouring of rabid nationalistic rhetoric and an imperialism based upon notions of racial superiority. It had less to do with the ideas of the honour of the warrior and more to do with a culture of dehumanisation of the other, which would help to make it consistent with the majority of other war crimes across Southeast Asia. And the notion of Bushido was co-opted by the Japanese military and stripped of its original meaning, which was really the codes of self-sacrifice, bravery in battle, but also of being the cultivated warrior, the samurai of the 16th century were not just brave and loyal fighters, but also cultured artisans and intellectuals, and this was part of what Bushido meant. Anyway, it was stripped of its original meanings and used in a way to inspire extraordinary cruelty. Churchill was clear to Archibald Wavell, the Allied Supreme Commander, whom he loathed with a passion, that Singapore would have to be fought for every inch of ground. Churchill said, "There must at this stage be no thought of saving troops or sparing the population. The battle must be fought to the bitter end at all costs. Commanders and senior officers should die with their troops. The honour of the British Empire and of the British Army is at stake. I rely on you to show no weakness or mercy in any form. With the Russians fighting as they are and the Americans so stubborn at Luzon, the whole reputation of our country and our race is involved." Churchill knew that it would be very difficult for him to look either Stalin or Roosevelt in the eye if Singapore fell. as morale crumbled and soldiers deserted, often with the justifiable claim that they had not been led properly, that they were not equipped properly, that there were hundreds of fighter planes idling on airfields in England that could be have been used to defend Singapore, there was the option of abandoning uniforms and sneaking on to civilian ships fleeing to Java. And this was a very attractive possibility for some soldiers. As the Japanese descended upon the city, they committed numerous atrocities, particularly the mass murder of staff at the Alexandra Hospital, where 320 men and one woman were killed, where the nurses were raped and the doctors were shot or thrown off the roof. The 22 Australian nurses who managed to escape the city fell into Japanese hands in Java and were driven into the sea to be machine-gunned. The final surrender of the garrison at Singapore from Percival to Yamashita was greeted with a degree of incredulity by Yamashita. As Percival attended the ceasefire without any real idea of what it was he was asking for, and Yamashita had to ask him several times, "Are you surrendering?" The incompetence that Percival signified was a real kind of code for the state of the British Empire by 1942. The Japanese had managed to seize Malaya with a cost of only 3,506 dead. The British had lost, and Australians had lost 7,500, and had sacrificed 138,000 prisoners, of which half were Indian. The loss of an enormous number of Indian troops and a significant number of Australian troops convinced both colonial and dominion subjects that the British had lost any moral right to rule when the war came to an end. And for those prisoners, their ordeal was just beginning. And we'll talk at length in future about the fate of Allied prisoners in Japanese camps and the fate of civilians who were caught up in the war. And the fate of colonial subjects who died at a rate vastly higher than the European soldiers who were prisoners. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.